everybody. It's time for It's All About Food. And I'm Karen Hartglass. It's August 12, 2014. Very nice day here in New York City. Cool breeze. I know I've said this every week this summer, but it has been the most incredible summer ever here where I live in New York. It has never gotten brutally hot. And I'm really liking it. I wanted to let you know, Responsible Eating and Living, my nonprofit, is hosting a free one-hour educational seminar on water, water safety, facts about water purification, the science behind the most effective ways of purifying water. You know I am passionate about clean, healthy water. And if you have any questions, concerns, now's the time. You can sign up and participate in this free online event. I'm really excited about it. It's the first time I'm going to be doing something like this. I'm partnering with Aquany, the people that make my favorite distiller, which is made in the United States. It's August 20th, 2014, and if you're interested, go to responsibleeatingandliving.com. Go over to the right side and scroll down where it says Water Made Wonderful, and you can reserve your spot. And just above that is the link to our brand new apps. Have you downloaded your app yet, your real app? I'm so excited about those. All right. That's all I have to tell you that's new. So let's get started with today's program. And I'm going to bring on my first guest, Patrice Jones. She's an ecofeminist writer, scholar, and activist who, along with Miriam Jones, co-founded Vine Sanctuary, an LGBTQ-run farmed animal sanctuary that operates with an understanding of the intersection of oppressions. She's the author of Aftershock, Confronting Trauma in a Violent World, a guide for activists and their allies, a wonderful book by a real favorite publisher, Lantern Books, and we are going to be talking about a new book that she has authored, The Oxen at the Intersection, another Lantern book. Patrice, how are you?
I'm doing very well, Karen. It's so great to hear your voice again.
It is good to hear your voice, and I miss you very much, and it's been way too long, and I don't know why I haven't seen you in, like, what?
10 years.
10 years. That's incredible. Well, you made a tremendous impression on me the few times that I've seen you in person, so it stays with me.
Ditto.
All right, so let's get to work here and talk about this book. Now, I remember just vaguely back in 2012, I didn't know much about the story that you talk about in this book, and I grabbed some information and read some stuff online. But this story is fascinating, frustrating, stupid, smart. It hit all my emotional buttons, and I'm continually questioning the human species and our motives. And you hit on all of them. Do you want to talk just briefly, a little introduction to get people interested in the oxen at the intersection?
Well, the oxen in question were two cows called Bill and Lou, who had been living at a college called Green Mountain College here in Vermont, where they had been used as farm equipment, yoked together by a wooden yoke and used to plow and sometimes to generate electricity. They were unofficial mascots of the school and the town of Pulteney, Vermont, until one day one of them, Lou, stepped in a gopher hole and sustained the equivalent of a sprained ankle. Not a life-threatening injury, but one that turned out to be one that meant he could no longer pull a plow. And since oxen work in teams, that meant that he and Bill could no longer work for the school. And so the school decided to kill and eat their mascots.
Mm-hmm.
And this as a symbol of sustainability. And this, not surprisingly, engendered a good bit of local controversy among townspeople who had come to care for these animals and alumni of the school who remembered them fondly. At the request of a local organization, we Vine Sanctuary stepped in to offer refuge to the oxen, who the school had said they were killing because they couldn't afford to feed them if they weren't working. So we said, that's great. We're happy to offer you a retirement home for the oxen free of charge to the college in the same way that we offer refuge to other animals when they're in circumstances where people are no longer able to feed them. And our offer was rudely refused. The question very quickly went viral due to social media, and there became a sort of a worldwide quest to, in the words of many people, save Bill and Lou. Tens and tens of thousands of people worldwide weighed in on the question. The college dug in its heels, sending out a contradictory, confusing, and stream of reasons why they had to kill these two oxen. And in the end, the local slaughterhouse refused to kill them, which left them wanting to kill but not able to do it, and they ended up splitting the difference, killing one of them and calling it euthanasia. And not allowing either of them to go to a sanctuary. And my book is, should I go on?
Please go on.
So my book, The Oxen at the Intersection, is, the whole thing was a calamity. And social change, activism proceeds by means of trial and error. If we want to make real change, we have to be willing to risk calamity. But we also have to have the discipline to look back and analyze our strategies and our tactics to see what went right and what went wrong. And so this new book of mine, The Oxen at the Intersection, is kind of a case study in calamity that tries to ask the question, how is it that tens of thousands of people were unable to save the lives of two oxen who everybody agreed had never done anyone any harm? So the first half of the book tells the story for those who were not in on it as it was happening, tells the story from our perspective here at the sanctuary, as we tried to coordinate a campaign that soon slipped the boundaries of our ability to in any way control what was happening. And then the second half of the book, which to me is the real heart of the book, analyzes what happened from several different perspectives, with the aim of learning something that might help us in future campaigns, not just animal protection campaigns, but future campaigns in activism, regardless of the type of activism.
So the first half, which is the story, to me, it was almost like a thriller. It reminded me of some whistleblower movies. I could see it as a movie, but the problem is, unlike most of the whistleblower movies that we've seen that have a happy ending, this did not have a happy ending.
Right. It did not.
It's just every page, the people at Green Mountain College, isn't that a lovely sounding name? Doesn't that make you bring up, well, maybe not for you anymore, but the images that you get are fresh air and natural environment and all good things. They had so many opportunities and they just kept making the wrong decisions.
Right. Hard-hearted decisions, decisions that didn't serve anyone really, and decisions that I'm not sure everybody. I wonder at the degree to which now there may be some regrets about decisions that were made in the heat of the moment.
I guess the one thing that surprised me above all of the opportunities that these people had to let these animals live, because you listed so many where one person or company was going to provide vegan food for the university, somebody was going to make a donation, the fact that they turned down economic-related opportunities just blew my mind because I thought everybody answered to money.
Right. But it shouldn't have blown your mind. And already you have just in talking about your own reactions to two of the aspects of this case, the images that come to your mind when you think of Green Mountain College and the failure of the college administrators to act in what would be called an economically rational way. are actually big parts of my analysis in the second half. The three sections in the second half concern the power of place, what I call dangerous intersections, meaning linkages among different forms of oppression, and animal psychology, by which I mean the psychology of human animals.
I think the second section is so important. There have been a number of books that have come out on how to be an animal advocate, but this is the best thing I've read so far because you're really working with hindsight, 2020, and it makes us understand the importance of all of the things that you're discussing.
Good.
From the story.
And I, good.
Yeah. So I just wanted to point out just a few. Can you just give a better, a more detailed description of these dangerous intersections that
absolutely.
You talk about?
Absolutely. And I also want to talk about the power of place in animal psychology. One thing I am hoping that people will read the book, obviously, or I wouldn't have written it, but I'm hoping that in addition to whatever we learned from looking at this particular case, I'm hoping that the book itself will serve as a kind of model about how to look at the problems we are trying to solve in activism. I think we need to think of the problems we are trying to solve as situations, complex intersections of material and social and psychological circumstances that need to be analyzed. And this book, I hope, provides a kind of a model of how do you look at a situation from lots of different angles to see where there might be opportunities for intervention. That's a very different way of doing activism than just seeing a problem and reaching for your one-size-fits-all tactic, whether it be a petition or pamphletings or protests, whatever the case may be. We need to get away from the knee-jerk reaching for particular favorite tactics and instead get good at analyzing situations in order to discover avenues for intervention where we can actually use rather than work against the energies that are inherent in the situation. We have to pay attention to the places that things happen. Everything that is done to animals by people is done by people. We'll get to people in a second. In particular places, places that are marked by their history, places that are shaped by material circumstances, the physiology of the ecosystem, but also by economic circumstances and the way that this particular place is hooked into national and global systems such as governments and economies. And all of these things may come into play in a particular situation. In our particular situation, the mythical image of Vermont as this green paradise, which turns out to be deeply rooted in Vermont history and an implicitly white idea, helps to explain why these college administrators in particular, but also many students, seem to feel that it was a matter of existential necessity that they be allowed to kill these animals. Because, in fact, their very sense of identity was deeply rooted in some mythological ideas about old school farming and the like. And by not recognizing the degree to which their identities were all bound up with this old school way of using oxen, which they portrayed as the natural, the true Vermont way of doing things, when in fact, actually that's the way that the European immigrants to Vermont did things, destroying the environment in the process. all of that was turned out to be relevant, and by not taking that into account adequately, that's one of the many ways we didn't do all that we could have done to save those two oxen.
You called that innocence at one point, where you know people had their understanding of the way things were, which were wrong. And when you don't know something, you don't understand something, and then you start to learn that everything you believed was wrong, many of us have a natural knee-jerk reaction to not want to believe that information because it just blows away our foundation.
Yeah. Innocence is a really important factor in the psychology of people in the United States, and particularly of white people in the United States. It's essential to believe oneself to be innocent in some sort of existential way. People are thought of as either good people or bad people, rather than thinking about good and bad acts. And thinking of people as capable of both good and bad acts. And of course, innocence depends on keeping yourself innocent of, unaware of, the violence upon which your privilege rests. And so, yeah, that was one of the many psychological factors rooted in a particular place that very strongly came in to play there. And I mentioned just now that innocence is particularly a part of white privilege, and it turns out that racism was one of many intersecting oppressions that factored into what seemed just to be a conversation among mostly white people about two animals. But in fact, whenever white people are talking among themselves, and especially when some of them are pretending to be the true carriers of the tradition of the land, race is always in there. As an unspoken and particularly virulent variable. That was certainly true in this instance.
As opposed to the people who used to live there and what they were eating and what their lifestyles were all about before we came and blew them all away.
And also ways of thinking about non-human animals, ways of growing food, et cetera. Ableism was a big issue here. Ableism is the term that we use, of course, for discrimination against, prejudice against people with disabilities. Ableism assumes that if you have particular capabilities, the having of particular capabilities makes you morally worthwhile, and not having particular capabilities makes you liable to be locked up, used, sterilized, etc. And ableism came into play in several different places here, from the very first idea that these were campus workers, that's what they had been called, these two oxen, but then when they became unable to work, then they were no longer worthy of care. That was a very disturbing element for many of the people who spoke up for Bill and Lou were not necessarily supporters of animal rights, but they were appalled by that particular idea. But there's also this implicit ableism built into speciesism, where the presumption is that people are inherently more morally worthwhile because we have particular capabilities that non-human animals don't have. And of course, we've learned over the years that most of the things we claim we can do and claim that non-human animals can't do, in fact, many other non-human animals can do quite well. Mm-hmm. But the real problem is the form of the argument. The form of the argument is that if you have certain capabilities, this is what gives you rights. This is what gives you moral worth, moral standing. This is what means we have to care about you. We have to care about you if you have rationality, and we don't have to care about you if you don't. And that's a very troubling way to think. It's the way that many people think about non-human animals, and it's deeply linked to speciesism. And then, of course, we also saw a good bit of sexism on both sides of the controversy during this one. all of that's rooted in a way of thinking about the world that some ecofeminist scholars call the logic of domination, the idea that mind over matter, reason over emotion, male over female, human over animal, culture over nature, etc.
Well, you discussed this with just using the words animal husbandry. That just sums it all up. Chilling when I read it. It's like, wow.
Yes, yes, yes. And at Green Mountain College, they actually did use that old school term, animal husbandry. And this is something that I think a lot of animal activists really have not begun to really think about anywhere near as carefully and clearly as we need to think about all uses of non-human animals by humans involves hands-on control of reproduction, and is deeply linked to sexism, and to ignore this is to ignore an essential component of the problem that you're trying to solve, and then trying to solve that problem while not looking at the ways that sex and gender play into our own ways of interacting with each other, then just compounds the problem. But when I was talking about the logic of domination, I was also sort of leading into what you said earlier when you said you were really surprised that the administrators at Green Mountain College had not behaved in an economically rational way.
Mm-hmm.
And that sort of brings me to the third set of things that I talk about in my book, The Action at the Intersection, which is that this whole campaign to save Bill and Lou proceeded, for the most part, as though Bill and Lou were the only animals in question. But in fact, we're animals too. Mm-hmm. And like every other kind of animal, we have our own ethology, our own psychology, and human psychology is a lot more complicated. We are not, in fact, economically rational thinking robots.
No, we're not. We like to think we are,
but the only reason we like to think we are is that whole logic of domination that speciesism is built into. And so we had this really interesting situation, and we see it a lot in animal activism, where animal activists who absolutely oppose speciesism are still, without really being aware of that they're doing so, operating within this logic of domination where it's assumed that humans are rational. And where it's assumed that rationality is superior to emotion, and separate from emotion, and all of these are actually really odd ideas that are not in any way borne out by what we know about how people actually do act. What we know about how people actually do act is that what you think of as you, your mind, your conscious awareness, is just a really tiny sliver of the work that your brain is doing all the time. The vast majority of what your brain is doing in terms of thinking is not available to you consciously. And a lot of times your brain is making decisions and then you're coming up with some story after the fact to explain.
Okay, so we have some technical difficulties here. And Patrice, whenever you're back, let me know. And I want to say I've really enjoyed reading this book. It's just packed with so many things that will challenge your mind. And even if you thought you had it all figured out, I'm sure there are things in here that are going to, like I said, challenge you. Patrice, are you back yet? Oh, gosh, how disappointed am I? I'm going to have to call her back on another show, I think, to talk more about this. I wanted to say that I think this might just be my real favorite for 2014. That's how good a book it is. And this microcosm, this simple story, touches on so many important points. So what is discussed in the book is, in ways you would not naturally see, racism, homophobia, sexism, speciesism, how they're all connected, and they all play into this story in not obvious ways. Okay. Oh, I'm just so disappointed that she's not with us, aren't you? That was just fascinating. Now, one of the things that I wanted to talk about to Patrice was something called polarization. And she cited some studies that have been done where people who believe in a certain philosophy, let's say conservatives and liberals. So the conservatives will listen to their conservative podcasts, the liberals will listen to their liberal podcasts, and they will associate with people that believe and support their particular philosophy to the point where they become more so in that philosophy. And that was kind of scary to me. But apparently it's very true. She also talks about something called groupthink, which is that sheep syndrome where we all start to follow one another and we don't even realize some of the things we're agreeing to or accepting, or we're acting in certain ways without really thinking about what it is we're doing, and oftentimes it can be very dangerous. One of the things that with regard to polarization, where one group is thinking one thing and another group is thinking another, and they're becoming more so in their thoughts, is that we lose the ability to see common ground. And this is where I'm going these days. I don't know if you've noticed this, but the last two shows, and it will be on this show, I have a segment that I'm calling to myself, Preaching to the Fire, where I have someone on the program who does not agree with my view of a certain issue, and we talk about it. And I think this is so important. We did this with the documentary, The Lone Vegan, Preaching to the Fire. Have you seen it yet? And if you haven't, please go to responsibleeatingandliving.com and watch it. It's only 70 minutes, and it's another example of talking to another polarized group, a group that strongly believes in certain issues and becomes more so in their belief because they're surrounded by people and listening to people that support their belief. But if we're going to move forward, we all need to be communicating, we all need to be talking to each other, and we need to find some common ground. We need to find the areas that we agree in and focus on those and move forward. And then perhaps that way we'll learn from each other. This story, The Oxen at the Intersection, you must read it. And it's just such a classic example of humanity and ego and what we will do and the decisions we make that may not be for the best. All right, well, I guess we're not going to get Patrice. I'm very sad about that. But we'll have to have her back on and talk more about this book, okay? In the meanwhile, you get the book and you read it and let me know what you think about it. Send me an email at info@realmeals.org. Right, now let's take a break, and I will be back with Sherilyn Harley-Lebon, and we're going to be talking about salt. Hello, everybody. We're back. I'm Karen Hartglass. You're listening to It's All About Food here on August 12, 2014. All right, let's talk about salt, shall we? My next guest is Sherilyn Harley-Lebon, and she is the co-chairman of the Project 21 National Advisory Board. She averages over 300 radio, television interviews, and news article citations per year on behalf of Project 21. She's currently president and CEO of Klar, K-L-A-R Strategies, a public affairs firm. She previously served as a political appointee in the George W. Bush administration, as a spokesman at the Republican National Committee, and as senior counsel for the U.S. Senate Judiciary Committee. She's a frequent guest on the Fox News Channel and national broadcast radio shows, and is a contributor to Town Hall and Politicalistas. All right. Welcome to It's All About Food, Sherilyn.
It's great to be with you.
Thank you very much. I'm having a good day. How about you?
I'm having a great day.
Good. All right. You want to talk about the proposed federal guidelines on salt?
All right. So, you know, I get where they're coming from, right? I mean, I think it's a laudable goal to try and get people to reduce the amount of sodium in their food. Because as we know, you know, there's a lot of sodium in processed foods. And as most Americans probably would admit, we probably eat too much processed food here, right?
Yep.
However, what troubles me, Karen, is that this sort of across-the-board guidelines that people are told and that are given, what troubles me is that not everyone is alike, all right? We have different bodies. We have different medical issues. And while it is a great idea to get people to reduce the sodium in their food, and I might add, it's a great idea to get people to do lots of things, right?
Mm-hmm. I agree. So far, we're totally in line.
Right. I don't like, I think people, you know, should reduce their smoking. I think people should reduce drinking. There's a whole lot of things that I think people should do. I think people should reduce the amount of coffee they're drinking.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think people probably eat too much fast food, the whole thing. But the problem is, when we do this sort of, okay, everybody needs to reduce their amount of sodium by so many milligrams a day, that's not true for everyone, Karen, all right? And the example I put in my article is for pregnant women. I had two children, given birth to two kids, and salt's the main way to get iodine to the thyroid gland. And when you're pregnant, all the organs in your body are in overdrive, right? And so for pregnant women, they're at an additional risk for iodine deficiency because of the increased thyroid hormone production, which growing babies need for brain development, and which, as someone who breastfed her children till they were 2 years old, breastfeeding moms need higher iodine intake as a necessary nutrient for infant growth. So, if I were pregnant or breastfeeding right now, this would not be the best advice for me, Karen, because I would need that. Okay, I would need that.
I agree that iodine is very important. We all need it. We've learned a lot through history how it's important for the thyroid. It's important for pregnant women, as you say. But half a teaspoon of iodized salt gives us about 1,150 milligrams of sodium, and that gives us all the iodine we need. We don't need to get additional sodium from salt in our fast foods and our restaurant foods.
But think about it, though, Karen.
I thought about it a lot.
If you're a breastfeeding woman and the FDA says, okay, well, you need to reduce your intake further by so many milligrams a day, I can tell you, again, as someone who breastfed my kids till they were 2 years old and as someone who needed those calories, my doctor was watching and doing my salt intake and thyroid tests. And I needed that additional. And that advice would have been not very good at all for me.
Well, I think we have to be really careful here because salt and iodine are not the same.
They are not.
And what we're really talking about and what the FDA is really talking about is the added salt in fast food, processed foods, restaurant foods, and most of those foods do not use salt with iodine. Most food manufacturing companies do not use salt with iodine.
But, Karen, I don't eat that kind of food. That's not how I'm getting my calories. I don't eat that.
Okay, where do you get your calories then? Where are you getting your food from?
Well, I eat a lot of vegetables.
Great.
I don't eat a lot of meat. And so I really need to watch, particularly, you know, when you're breastfeeding because you need a high amount of calories every day. So So I really needed to watch that. And
so
I needed my added sodium.
You can easily take a supplement and know exactly what you're getting. You can
had
eat
those.
Vegetables.
Had all those.
Or you
had
can have a
those.
Little bit of salt. But you don't need additional sodium without iodine from fast food or restaurant food or anything like that. That's what the FDA is talking about. And they're really talking about the fact that the average American gets 3,400 or more milligrams of sodium per day, which we know,
you know what,
is
though,
our major cause.
But you know what, though, Karen? I don't agree with that. I still think that the FDA has to be really careful, because I'll tell you, I think their guidelines are great for people that have hypertension and that have issues where they really need to reduce their sodium. Okay? I get that. And that's great. But those people probably are under a doctor's care and are getting that advice. Okay? They're getting that
advice. I guess it's not making any sense to me, because people who are paying attention to this and want to get the right amount of iodine for whatever their needs are, and they're working under a doctor's care, they're going to be fine. But it's the people that don't know anything about nutrition and are not reading labels and are not paying attention, and they're eating at restaurants and they're getting processed food and they're getting salt without iodine, way too much sodium. And, I mean, heart disease is the major cause.
It is.
Stroke is the major cause.
But Karen, what I'm talking about, I get that, and I think we agree. I get that. Those people should reduce their salt intake.
But they can't if they're eating fast food, processed food, restaurant food that's got high. I just know, you know,
I eat very... Those people are going to have problems anyhow. Yeah, it's sodium, but they shouldn't be eating that food in the first place. Anyhow.
But that's what these voluntary guidelines are all about. And they're voluntary.
Also,
they're directed towards manufacturers of food.
But it's not just the voluntary guidelines with respect to sodium. It is trans fat. It's all of these things where the government is trying to encourage the people to eat that food. But you know what? You can't control what people eat. People have choice, and they're going to make that.
When I go to a restaurant, and I don't go out very often. Why? Because the food is too salted. Now, I went out this weekend because it was a special event, and I met with people, family and friends, and ate in a restaurant. And I came home, and I had such dark circles under my eyes. My muscles got stiff. Why? Because I don't eat a lot of salt. And then when I go out and consume food that people are eating every day that has way too much salt in it, it affects me negatively and many other people. So what's wrong with having a low amount of salt added into food, salt that doesn't have iodine in it, and people that want to add salt to their food, it's that easy.
They're welcome to
do
that.
You can take it out, but you can put it in.
But here's the thing, Karen. It's more than just, you know, it's not just the fact that sodium is added to the food. I mean, the way restaurants, often when I go to a restaurant, I ask people how they prepare their food.
Mm-hmm.
And if it's not prepared the way that I think it should be prepared, we leave. So, I mean, people really need to be a little bit more curious about the food they're eating. And if they think that it's not working for them and they've got health restrictions, then you know what? They need to ask questions. Okay? Again, people need to be taking responsibility for what they eat, instead of blaming everyone else. I just, you know, I'm not buying it, Karen.
I'm not blaming anybody. I've been a vegan for over 25 years. I know all about asking questions in restaurants. Believe me, I've been doing it most of my life. But when we're talking about food that's out there, it doesn't make sense that it's loaded with salt. You can't take it out.
But Karen, it's not just salt. There are a lot of other additives that, you know, I'm not convinced either that salt is the problem here with food that's being prepared and processed food and in restaurants. There are a whole lot of other additives, and I don't think that salt is necessarily the sole bad guy, okay? There's MSG. I mean, you're a vegan for 25 years. You go into the grocery store and you read the ingredients in food, don't you? You see that there's 25, right?
Mm-hmm.
I stop reading after 2 or 3. And I say, you know what? This isn't what I'm going to feed my kids. The other day, I went in and I tried to buy popsicles for the kids. My mother and I left out of the grocery store. We said we just can't buy them. You know, it's a hot day. We're at the beach.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sorry, I can't give my children
artificial colors, tons of sugar.
Well, it's well,
no,
it's
real fruit.
It's beyond that. It's beyond that. It is carrageen. It's all sorts of things which just, you know, aren't going to work for our family. But the bottom line here is, And to make salt the boogeyman, I think we are unfairly picking at one industry when there's a number of other industries that produce additives.
Well,
that if we're
going
to play the blame game, then
FDA
we need to blame everybody.
Okay, I'm blaming everybody. The FDA is so insufficiently funded that they can barely do the job that they say they're going to do. And, you know, I agree there should – I would like to have a lot more regulations on our food, and I would like to see organic plant food encouraged as the basis of our diet. We shouldn't have toxic pesticides and herbicides in our food.
I don't agree with that, Karen, because I think that, once again, you can't regulate what people eat. Because
no,
people
you can't,
are going to decide.
But you should give them the simplest form, and if they want to thicken it and fill it up with toxins and whatever else they want, people are free to do that. But I want to start with clean food. And when my food is, you know, when the foods that are supported by our tax dollars and subsidies and benefits contain toxic chemicals and pesticides, you know, who needs that?
Again, people have the choice. They can read the labels. They can educate themselves. People have heard of Google. That's the wonderful thing about technology. Wonderful thing about technology. If you are curious about what you're eating, you have the ability. You can, if you don't have internet at home or a computer, you can go to one of our fabulous public libraries in this country and get on the computer and read about all the wealth of information that's available. And you have the power to make the choice about what you eat, right?
That's right. But the problem is that people, but most people, you know, they're not that savvy, and they're not focused in nutrition.
Karen, if you can read, you can find this information. Now,
well,
if you're
illiterate,
then
we've
got other problems.
Well, I know, but, you know, they can go to your blog, for example, and, you know, some of the things that you've said are very vague, and I think they could lead people down the wrong path.
Well, then you know what? They can fact-check my information, Karen.
Yep,
they can fact-check it. If they don't like it, they can fact check it. But I'll tell you, I don't like the FDA giving this type of broad advice to people who may not have hypertension, who may not have diabetes, and who may need a certain level of sodium intake because of their particular health needs. I'm not comfortable, and I come from a family with several doctors, and if they're not doctors, then I also have people in my family who work in affiliated health fields. They're either physical therapists, occupational therapists, work in labs. So I've grown up around people, you know, concerned about what they feed their children, what they feed their families. And again, processed food might not be great for a lot of people, but that's the choice they make.
What do you think about
that's the choice they make?
What do you think about the plumping of chicken injecting salt solutions into meat in order to increase its weight and increases the amount of sodium unnaturally and then being labeled as natural?
Again, I'm not prepared to blame sodium because they're injecting the chicken.
So you think that's okay?
No, I don't. I didn't say that. But they also inject the chickens with lots of other things. I mean, why are we picking on salt?
I tell people not to eat it. But, you know, salt is one of the things that manufacturers do.
And it's also antibiotics. And it's also all sorts of other things.
Yep.
Again, Karen, you know, you're picking on salt. But, my dear, there's a whole lot of other things. I mean, if you're gonna have a problem with salt, you gotta have a problem with a litany of other things.
What we talk about here on It's All About Food is eating a diet that is based on organic plant foods, minimally processed whole foods, very little salt, sugar, and added oils.
That's something for everyone to strive for.
Absolutely.
Isn't that great? That's something for everyone to strive for.
Okay, but, we can agree on that.
Yeah, that's something for everyone to strive for.
But you know,
again,
but I'm not, Karen, I
can't tell people to do that. What works for my family and what works for you may not work for everybody. And we shouldn't be in the business of being the food police and telling people.
No, but what the government needs to do is make the healthiest foods affordable, and they're not doing that. And they need to have guidelines to direct people towards the healthiest foods.
But what do you think? I mean, so you think it's the government's job to make food healthy and affordable? Okay.
They should make the healthiest foods the most affordable, yes.
Okay.
Because right now they're not. Right now they're making cereals to be grown to feed animals to feed
but
people
Karen,
the most affordable.
That,
they're making
Karen,
corn syrup.
I think there are a whole lot of other problems with what you've said, because let me tell you something. I don't know when the last time you've been to an impoverished neighborhood, but I go to plenty.
Yes.
Those places are food deserts.
Yes,
the
I know
bodegas
all about them.
In New York City, do you know what they're selling there?
Yeah.
And why isn't that Whole Foods and Trader Joe's don't go into the hood?
Oh, I know. Because
they get no incentive
they know
to go in there.
Absolutely.
They get
but
no,
you know what?
They get no tax breaks to go in there. How about if the government focuses on some incentives so that these impoverished neighborhoods aren't food deserts.
I absolutely
so that,
agree with that.
So
but
that
you know what's in
farmers
those food
market,
deserts? Fast food.
So that
fast
farmers
food
market.
Salt.
That's, but you know what, Karen? Again, you're picking on salt. And I'm telling you, there's a whole lot of other problems besides salt, my dear.
Yeah.
And if that is all these people have to eat, then my goodness, where do you think they're going to eat, Karen? Where do you think they're going to go to feed their families?
And right.
That's all they've got. And then the bodega only has canned food. Canned food, canned peas, canned string beans. Are the farmers market in their neighborhood?
No,
no.
But those canned should be very
fruit?
Low in sodium.
Or how about?
I mean,
when
I buy a lot
about,
of canned beans and they have no
wait
sodium.
Wait a minute,
in
Karen.
Them.
How about a decent grocery store that has frozen vegetables? How about
hey,
that?
I'm not arguing with you, but that frozen chicken shouldn't be plumped up with extra sodium.
Again, we're back to the sodium.
Well, that's
I'm
what
just
we're talking
saying,
about today.
Let's go, but let's go back to square
I mean,
one and offering
and
these families options.
Syrup, you know?
Fine, all of that, but these families don't have options.
Yes.
You live in a world where you have the ability to be a vegan, and you can afford it. What about these families?
Well,
all
my diet
is
based on beans and rice, which is like the cheapest food you can possibly eat, and I encourage everybody to live on primarily
well,
these
foods.
Well, with
all due respect, these bodegas aren't necessarily
yes, but
selling.
That's not related to salt. That's just another problem, and we should be addressing those problems, too. I agree that everyone should have access to whole, minimally processed plant foods with no salt in it.
Yeah, but Karen, that's great. Again, these are laudable goals to work towards.
Yes.
But my point is, if it's not available to people who are living in the hood and have a bodega, we can talk about it ad nauseum. But until the government comes up with solutions for people to live in neighborhoods and have incentives so that real grocery stores will go into neighborhoods and offer people alternatives, then you know what? We're going to keep having a hypertension problem. We're going to keep having an obesity problem because this is what's being offered to Americans. And that is my problem with this.
Okay.
That's what the government should focus on.
Well, thank you, Sherilyn, for your information today and for joining me on It's All About Food.
Thank you. It's been my pleasure, Karen.
Okay. Take care.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. All right. Well, that was Sherilyn Harley Lamon, and you know about her thoughts regarding salt and food access. So we have just a few minutes left, and again, I wanted to remind you about the upcoming webinar on August 20th, all about water, clean water, water purification. That's August 20th. It's free. You can sign up at responsibleeatingandliving.com. And just before we go, I wanted to share my restaurant experience this weekend. You know, I was talking about going to eat out, which I rarely do. And aside from the salt, and there was salt in some of the food I ate, I was down in the Lower East Side of New York, and this neighborhood is really full of energy and so exciting. So my partner, Gary, is in a play in the Fringe Festival here in New York City, the Fringe, and it's called No One Asked Me, and it's all about illegal immigration. It's a fascinating story. And so I went to a number of performances with some friends and family and got to try some of the restaurants in the area. So here's what I was amazed at. We went to a pizza place called Paula Pizza. And a beautiful, open, airy restaurant. The weather's been great. The front of the restaurant was all open, a lot of outdoor seating. Their menu had regular pizzas. They had vegan pizzas with daya cheese and gluten-free pizzas. So I could get a vegan gluten-free pizza. They were beautiful, and it was a lot of fun. And then I went to another place called the Falafel Shop and got, usually in a falafel shop, there's plenty of vegetarian food. But this one, they also offered vegan gluten-free pita bread, and they had green juice. So I was pretty much in heaven. Now, those restaurants weren't too bad for Salt. It was another restaurant that I went to, chosen by some other people, and it was family dining, and they were very nice. They did order some vegan salads and foods for the few vegan and vegetarian people, but there were two beautiful fresh salads. One was endive salad and one was an arugula salad, but it was like they threw a handful of salt on top of both of these plates of salad, and it was terrible. It was really terrible. And as I was saying earlier, I woke up the next day, dark circles under my eyes. I went to do my yoga practice, and I was so stiff. I could barely touch my toes. I could not do a lot of the flexible exercises that I normally do, and it was so profound to me. I can read study after study about how many people have been evaluated from the amount of salt that they've been eating and how it impacts their own diet. But when you see it yourself, when you see and feel it, what it does to you, it's more powerful to me than anything else. And the point I was trying to make, I want to bring it up again, and that is the salt that we were talking about that we want to really reduce is the salt in processed foods, manufactured foods, prepared food that a lot of people buy today. A lot of people don't cook. And most of this salt does not have iodine in it. So the whole iodine argument goes out the window. It's just unnecessary salt. Well, I enjoyed that. I hope you did too. Well, before we go, I want to remind you about our Real apps. And another thing I wanted to tell you about is I have a bunch of muffin recipes up on the responsibleeatingandliving.com website. I love making muffins, and I kind of have a loose principle that I don't eat bread products unless I make them. Now, unfortunately, I think I bake quite a bit because I love to. And I'm always coming up with new muffin recipes. I have a new one, butter pecan muffins. Of course, they're vegan. Of course, they're gluten-free. And, wow, they are so good. You can find a link to that recipe at the bottom of the Responsible Eating and Living website, butter pecan muffins. Don't they sound good? They are good. And there are lots of wonderful recipes that we have. You can always go to the Real Favorites. I have a category called Real Favorites in our recipe selection, and these are the recipes that I'm making all the time, all the time, all the time. Well, there you have it. I hope to bring back Patrice Jones sometime soon. I wasn't quite finished with that interview, but in the meanwhile, please pick up a copy of her book, The Oxen at the Intersection, and read it. It's so important. All right. Other than that, have a very delicious week.